Welcome to Professor Todd Landman's podcast series. In today's podcast, Todd talks about new research looking at how to compare one country's human rights record with its neighbour and what this might mean for those looking to promote human rights.
I was approached by actually a business analyst in Geneva and some academics in London about could we look at human rights performance in a way that would be interesting to the business community. And one of my critiques of existing measures of human rights is that they give you an absolute score. So country X gets a score of 5 on a performance measure, and country Y gets a score of 4, where 5 is worse and 4 is better. And I thought, okay, that's an absolute score, but it doesn't take into account any of the country conditions. So it would be unfair, maybe, to judge one of the countries as having a 5 when, in fact, it had deep problems of poverty, you know, infrastructural development was low, a number of other things affecting the country that made its human rights performance problematic. So we published a paper in the Journal of Human Rights a few years ago called Relativizing Human Rights, where we use quantitative analysis on country measures. We came up with a sort of factor score that looked at sort of 5 or 6 different human rights measures and came up with a factor score of country performance. And we regressed this on a number of explanatory variables and saved what's called the residual, sort of what's unexplained in the variation in human rights performance. And for us, that became a kind of over and under performance indicator, right? So you have your level of performance that's expected given country conditions, and then you're either overperforming or underperforming on that. And what that does is create a different ranking altogether. When you do that analysis, what you find is that there's some countries that are doing a lot better than expected. So they might be relatively poor, they might have relatively weak infrastructures, and yet they have a good performance in human rights. And equally, you'd have countries that should be doing better, that there are areas of improvement that for some reason rights are just not coming up to standard.
So how did all that influence this current research project?
We also need to think about not just countries as little sealed containers that don't have any influence on other countries. The world is a very fluid place, particularly now with the internet and social media and information communications technologies more generally. And so we have some econometricians at Loughborough University and Middlesex University that took data that I had used in other projects, the Relativizing Project and some other projects on inequality and human rights, and started to look at the spatial patterns in the data. The idea here was that were there groups of countries that were performing better on human rights precisely because they were all sort of within reasonable proximity and other countries that weren't doing so well? And so the genesis of the project was really to look at that spatial distribution of human rights performance and to correlate it with economic performance.
What did you go on then to look at specifically and why?
So specifically, we looked at what are the time series trends in human rights improvement or the decline in human rights performance around the world, and how does that correlate to economic performance? Because we know that recently there's been a recession, but generally speaking, from the 1980s onward, we've seen a lot of regions recover. Latin America recovered, for example. We've seen transitions in Eastern Europe and economic performance in many of the former Soviet states, for example, or at least the Eastern Bloc states, many of them joining the European Union. So there's been economic improvement and there's been human rights improvement in a lot of states. And we were trying to see if those two processes were in some way related nationally. And then equally, we wanted to know whether being in particular regions or being in close proximity to particular states made a difference for that human rights performance.
Now, let's talk a bit briefly about where you get your data from and what sorts of information it contains.
Really, since I've been working on human rights, there have been a number of global data sets developing on human rights as well as on economic indicators. So we go to the World Bank Development Indicators data set for things like per capita GDP, which is a general measure of income. We also have measures from University of Texas on inequality, land inequality, and income inequality we've collected data on. There are 4 or 5 major providers of civil and political rights protection scales, and we combine those into the factor score. And then there are other variables like the level of democracy. There's a project run out of University of Maryland called the Polity Project on the level of democracy. So we take disparate sets of data, assemble them into a large flat file. One of the projects I've been working on for the last few years with funding from the Economic and Social Research Council here in the United Kingdom is to build a human rights atlas. So we actually build a flat file of data on all the countries in the world from 1980 until the present across 200 different indicators. We have legal indicators, we have socioeconomic sort of country level data, and then we have human rights performance indicators all in one big flat file. Not only does that allow us to visualize what's going on in the world using sort of, well, it's our own software, but it looks like Google Maps in a way. But we can also then use those flat files for further analysis of the kind that we're talking about here.
Now, you talk about two broad clubs when it comes to human rights performance. What do those clubs look like now, and how have they changed over time?
The two clubs in this paper, that broad clubs, are the sort of wealthy industrialized nations that are good human rights performers and the lesser developed countries that struggle with human rights performance. There will be exceptions, there's no question, but broadly speaking, the measures sort of differentiate the world into these two broad clubs.
You wanted to look at how one country's human rights performance might compare with its neighbour. So how did you go about doing that?
We use standardised measures that are designed for this purpose, which is to say that they use source material, they code the source material according to a standard scale, and then it's a very crude and some would argue a reductionist way of looking at performance. But nevertheless, you can say this country in this year had a better score on this particular set of rights than that country. So it does actually let you have that kind of comparison. The limitations is that the one club tends not to have a lot of variation within it, and the other club doesn't have a lot of variation within it. So there's a lot of critique around you're not really getting a lot of variation. Over time, things change quite a bit, and we also find some change between regions that still allows us to do our comparisons.
When it came to looking at GDP and human rights, then what did you find?
Well, since the 1980s, there's a standard finding that countries with higher levels of per capita GDP have a better protection of civil and political rights. So this is a standard finding. It's very much in line with the larger literature on development and democracy. And it's one of those things, if you take a sample of countries from 1950 until today, or if you take it in the 50s and today, you get roughly the same finding. There's strong correlation between income, high levels of income, and greater protection of human rights. The story around that is that more resource available to a state means that it can buy off opposition groups, decrease violence, have stronger political institutions, provide for people, and in general have stronger legal institutions and better systems of governance to protect human rights. That's the general story, and it's borne out by that very simple relationship between development and democracy. The real world is much more complicated, but that's this kind of standard finding that we see across the statistical analysis.
And was there any indication then that being geographically located near to a country with a good human rights record somehow benefited the neighbouring country?
Absolutely. So what we did in the study was to conduct what's called gravity modeling. Now, this sounds really funny, but it makes reference literally to Newtonian theory in that countries or objects with larger mass will attract objects with smaller mass. So the whole theory of gravity, of course, the reason you and I are sitting in these chairs is because the Earth is very big relative to us. Quite simple. Now, if you have a very big reasonable sort of defender of human rights country, and it's surrounded by a bunch of states that are smaller, then the probability of those small states having a better human rights record is much higher. So there's a proximity effect, so that the distance you are from a good, large human rights protector, actually determines the probability of your human rights performance being better.
And did the size of a country make a difference?
Well, actually, before we get to size, yes, it does. But also, the obverse of this logic is true, so that if you're a small country living next to a very large human rights violating country, then the probability of any improvement is much reduced. So satellite states around China, for example, struggle with human rights performance. Those around the European Union, the United States, do not as much, right? So it's all relative, but that proximity and distance is really, really important. Size matters. We know that large countries, generally speaking, have more problems with human rights. It's kind of like if you think about entropy in chemistry, that the more particles you have, the more sort of entropy you're going to have in a system. And that's true within any large society. The potential for conflict and violation of human rights is much greater. If one thinks about India, let's say, versus Costa Rica, both sort of nominally democratic countries, one with a very small population, one with a very large population, the probability of human rights problems in India are much greater than in Costa Rica.
What do these findings tell us about the way in which we look at human rights within countries and when comparing countries?
I think when we look at countries, we always need to think about what are the country conditions. So there might be a very well-developed legal system, but then there may not be particularly strong infrastructure. So you can't get to populations. So you don't really know what's happening to people in remote areas, for example. You need to think about how country conditions affect human rights performance outside of official state institutions, and equally across countries. There are cultural differences, different cultural understandings, different legal systems themselves. If you have a confessional legal system, for example, there's a very strong institutional incentive for police and others involved very early on in the sort of cycle of justice to engage in torture, because they think that will lead to a confession, which will get a conviction in court. Now, if you change the legal system and say, we don't need confession, what we need is a sort of contested, open dialogue trial by peers, then that might change the incentive structure, where a suspect goes on trial and the trial presents evidence which is then cross-examined in a much different way than a kind of confessional system. So there you have a cultural institutional melange, right, which may have an impact on the human rights situation. And so when you're just comparing countries one to the other, you always need to bear in mind what's the institutional structure, what's the economic situation, what's the history, has it been colonized? You know, all sorts of factors you need to take into account before you merely pronounce that one country's better than another.
I wonder if there are some key sort of takeaway messages for those countries and international organizations that are looking to promote human rights from this piece of research, Todd.
Well, I think the proximity question is really important. I think that if we continue to advocate around human rights and work with satellite states that are around large human rights violators, for example, there's a lot of work sort of how can we improve human rights in China. That will come, I think, at some point. But I think also there's a lot of work that could be done in the states that surround China. More assistance working on human rights institutions, working with advocacy groups, NGOs, academics, etc., to, in a way, overcome some of the geographic problems and some of the sort of larger logics that are at play there, so that advocacy efforts could be targeted more effectively at those areas that where we think, you know, a difference could be made and where we think a difference needs to be made given some of those obstacles.
Todd Landman was talking to me, Chris Garrington, about economic geography and human rights, a research paper by Todd Landman, Hugh Edwards, David Kernahan and Aziz Van Nessa. In our next podcast, we'll be talking about the implications of naming and framing when it comes to asking people about important human rights questions in a real-life scenario. This series is produced by Research Podcasts.